Chapter 38. WCL Super Hoop 88. 2 p.m. Saturday, July 22nd, 1988. Swindon Stadium, Wessex. Reading Whackers. Tim O'Farthens, captain. Molly the Mark Stern, midfield. Tim the Mouse McCall, forward striker. Gretchen Barker Koss, striker. Wallace, back to front, Acadia, defence. George Rhino McNasty, striker, dismissed. Alessandra Lasardi, roque taker. Bone Crusher McSneed, forward hoop. Freddie Dribbler Lonis, peg defence. Duchess of Sheffield, wingman. Legal team, Wap Caplet and Swartz. Linesman, Bruce Giffords. Coach, Geoffrey Snurge. Swindon Mallets. Aubrey Jam, captain. Alan Biffo Mandible, midfield. Snake Spillikin, forward striker. Grunk, Neanderthal, defence, dismissed. Warg, Neanderthal, striker, dismissed. Dorf, Neanderthal, peg defence, dismissed. Stiggins, Neanderthal, roque taker, dismissed. Smudger, Blarney, forward hoop. Zim, Neanderthal, striker, dismissed. Penelope Hra, mid-hoop wingman. Thursday next, manager slash midfield. Legal team, Runcorn and Twizzit. Sub, John Jono Swift, dismissed. Coach, Alf Widdershane. I took up my station at the 20-yard line and looked around the green. The rhododendron bushes in the centre occluded my vision of the back hoop right. I glanced up at the scoreboard and clock. 2 minutes to go. There were three other natural hazards that we were to play around on the green. The tea party, which even now is being stocked by volunteers, the garden roller, and the Italian sunken garden. Once the tea party volunteers were safe, and the parson umpire was happy his curate linesmen were all in position, the klaxon went off with a loud blare. Many things happened at once. There were two almost simultaneous clacks as both teams whacked off, and I ran forward instinctively to intercept the pass from Biffo. Since the whackers didn't think I was of any use, I had been left unmarked, and Biffo's pass came sailing towards me. I was flushed by the excitement and caught it in mid-air, smashing it towards the opponent's ball for what looked like an aerial roque. It didn't work. I missed by about a foot. The opponent's ball carried on to the 40-yard line, where McCall blasted it through the back hoop right. The classic Bomperini opener. I didn't have time to think about it, as there was a shout of, "Thursday!" from Aubrey, and I turned to make a swipe at the opposition's ball. The klaxon went, and everybody stopped playing. I had touched the opponent's ball when south of the 40-yard line, after it had been passed from the last person to have hit a red ball in the opposite direction. One of the more obvious offside transgressions. "Sorry, guys," I said, as the whackers lined up to take their penalty. O'Farthens took the shot and catapulted our ball into the rhododendrons. As George tried to find it, and with our other ball out of play in the Italian sunken garden, the whackers went on the offensive and hooped three times before we'd even realized it. Even when we found the ball, we were too dispersed, and after another 28 minutes of hard defensive footwork, managed to end the first third with only four hoops to Reading's eight. "There are too many of them," panted Snake. 8-4 is the worst opening score for a Super Hoop final ever." "We're not beat yet," replied Jam, taking a drink. "Thursday, you played well." "Well?" I returned, taking off my helmet and wiping the sweat from my brow. "I sank the ball with my first whack and dropped as a hoop on the offside penalty."
"But we still scored a hoop, and we would have already lost if you hadn't joined us. You just need to relax more. You're playing as though the world depended on it."
The team didn't know it,
but I was. Just calm down a bit. Take a second before you whack, and you'll be fine. Biffo, good work. A nice hoop, Penelope. But if you chase their wingman again, you might be booked.
Ugh,
replied Penelope. Mr. Jam, said Mr. Runcorn, who had been working on a rear-guard legal challenge to the anti-Neanderthal ruling. Yes? Do you have a case? I'm afraid not. I can't seem to find any grounds for one. The non-human precedent was overruled on appeal. I'm very sorry, sir. I think I'm playing very badly. Might I resign and bring on the legal substitute? It's not your fault, said Jam kindly. Have the substitute lawyer continue the search. Runcorn bowed and went to sit on the lawyer's bench, where a young man in a badly fitting suit had been sitting silently throughout the first third.
That Duchess is murder, muttered Biffo breathlessly. She almost had me twice.
Isn't striking an opponent a red card three-hoop penalty offence? I asked. Of course, but if she can take out our best player, then it might be worth it. Keep an eye on her, everyone. Mr. Jam? It was the referee, who told us further litigation had been brought against our team. We dutifully approached the Porter Court, where the judges were just signing an amendment to the World Croquet League Book of Law.
What is it?
As a result of the Danish Economic Scapegoat Act coming into law, people of Danish descent are not permitted to vote or take key jobs.
When did this law come into effect?
5 minutes ago. I looked up at Kane in the VIP box, where he smiled and waved at me.
So? Asked Jam. Kane's dopey ideas have no reflection on croquet. This is sport, not politics.
The Whacker's lawyer, Mr. Wap Caplet, coughed politely. In that, you would be mistaken. The definition of key job includes being a highly paid sports personality. We have conducted some background checks and discovered that Miss Penelope Hrar was born in Copenhagen. She's Danish.
Jam was silent. I might have been born there, but I'm not Danish, said Hrar, taking a menacing step towards Wap Caplet. My parents were on holiday at the time.
We are well aware of the facts, intoned Wap Caplet, and have already gained judgment on this matter. You were born in Denmark, you are technically Danish, you are in a key job, and you are thus disqualified from playing on this team.
Balls, yelled Aubrey. If she was born in a kennel, would that make her a dog?
Replied the attorney thoughtfully. It's an interesting legal question. Penelope couldn't contain herself any longer and went for him. It took four of us to hold her back, and she had to be forcibly restrained and frog-marched from the green.
Down to five players, muttered Jam, below the minimum player requirement.
Yes, said Mr. Wap Caplet glibly. It appears the Whackers are the winners.
I think not, interrupted our substitute lawyer, whose name we learned was Twizzit.
As my most esteemed colleague so rightly pointed out, the rule states thus. Any team that fails to start the game with the minimum of six players forfeits the match. The way I see it, the match has already begun, and we can carry on playing with five. Your Honours?
The judges put their heads together for a moment, and then pronounced, This court finds for the Swindon Mallets in this matter. They may continue to play into the second third with five players.
We walked slowly back to the touchline. Four of the Neanderthal players were still sitting on the bench, staring off into space.
Where's Stig? I asked them.
I didn't get an answer. The klaxon for the second third went off, and I grabbed my mallet and helmet and hurried onto the green.
New strategy, everyone, said Jam, to myself, Smudger, Snake and Biffo, all that remained of the Swindon Mallets. We play defensively to make sure they don't score any more hoops. Anything goes, and watch out for the Duchess.
The second third was probably the most interesting third ever seen in World League croquet. To begin with, Biffo and Aubrey whacked both our own balls into the rhododendrons. This was a novel tactic and had two consequences. Firstly, that we weren't going to score any hoops in the middle third by natural hooping, and second, that we denied the opposition any roquets off our balls. No advantage to win, clearly, but we weren't trying to win, we were fighting for survival. The Whackers had only to score 30 hoops and hit the centre peg to win outright. and the way it was going, we wouldn't make the last third. Staving off the inevitable, perhaps, but World League croquet is like that. Frustrating, violent, and full of the unexpected. "No prisoners!" yelled Biffo, waving his mallet above his head in a display of bravado that would sum up our second-third strategy. It worked. Freed from the constraint of ball defence, we all went into the attack, and together caused some considerable problems to the whackers, who were thrown by the unorthodox playing tactics. At one point I yelled, "Offside!" and made up something so outrageously complex that it sounded as if it could be true. It took 10 minutes of precious time to prove that it wasn't. By the time the second third ended, we were almost completely exhausted. The whackers now led by 21-12, and we won another 8 only because bone crusher McSneed had been sent off for trying to hit jam with his mallet, and Biffo had been concussed by the Duchess. "How many fingers am I holding up?" asked Alf. "Fish," said Biffo, eyes wandering. "You okay?" asked Landon, when I returned to the stands to see him. "I'm okay," I puffed. "I'm out of shape, though." Friday gave me a hug. "Thursday," hissed Landon, in a hushed voice, "I've been thinking. Where did that piano actually come from?"
"What piano?"
"The one that fell on Cindy."
"Well, I suppose it just, well, fell, didn't it? What are you saying?"
"That was a murder attempt."
"Someone tried to assassinate the assassin with a piano?"
"No, it hit her accidentally. I think it was intended for you."
"Who'd want to kill me with a piano?"
"I don't know. Have there been any other unorthodox attempts on your life recently?"
"No."
"I think you're still in danger, sweetheart. Please be careful."
I kissed him again and stroked his face with a muddy hand. "Sorry," I muttered, trying to rub it off and making it worse. "But I've got too much to think about at the moment." I ran off and joined Jam for the last third pep talk. "Right," he said, handing out the Chelsea buns. "We're going to lose this match, but we're going to go out in glory. I don't want it to be said that the Mallets didn't fight until the last man standing. Right, Biffo?"
"Trilby."
We all knocked our fists together and made the harumph noise again. The team reinvigorated, except for me. It was true that no one could say we didn't try, but for all Jam's well-meaning rhetoric, in 3 weeks' time, the earth would be a smouldering radioactive cinder, and no amount of tarnished glory could save Swindon or anyone else. But I helped myself to a Chelsea bun and a cup of tea anyway. "I say," said Twizzet, who had suddenly appeared in the company of Stig.
"Have a bun," said Aubrey. "We're going out in style."
But Twizzet wasn't smiling. "We've been looking at Mr. Stig's genome."
"His what?"
"His genome. The complete genetic plan of him and the other Neanderthals."
"And?"
Twizzet rummaged through some papers. "They were all built between 1939 and 1948 in the Goliath Bioengineering Labs. The thing is, the prototype Neanderthal could not speak in words that we could understand. So they were built using a human voice box." Twizzet gave a curious half-smile, as though he had produced a spare ace from his sleeve and announced with great drama, "The Neanderthals are 1.03% human."
"But that doesn't make them human," I observed. "How does this help us?"
"I agree, they're not human," conceded Twizzet, with the ghost of a smile. "But the rules specifically exclude anyone non-human. Since they have some human in them, they technically can't fall into this category."
There was another long pause. I looked at Stig, who stared back and raised his eyebrows.
"I think we should lodge an appeal," muttered Jam, leaving his Chelsea bun half-eaten in his haste. "Stig, have your men limber up." The judges agreed with us. The 1.03% was enough to prove they weren't non-human, and thus could not be excluded from play. While Wap Caplet ran off to search the croquet statutes for a reason to appeal, the Neanderthals, Grunk,
Warg, Dorf, Zim and Stig limbered up as the whackers looked on nervously. Neanderthals had often been approached to play, as they could run all day without tiring. But no one until now had ever managed to get any.
"Okay, listen up," said Jam, gathering us around. "We're back in the game at full strength. Thursday, I want you to stay on the benches to regain your breath. We're going to fool them with a Puchonski switch. Biffo is going to take the red ball from the 40-yard line over the rhododendron bushes, past the Italian sunken garden and into a close position to hoop five. Snake, you'll take it from there and croquet their yellow. Stig will defend you. Mr. Warg, I want you to mark their number five. He's dangerous, so you're going to have to use any tricks you can. Smudger, you're going to foul the Duchess. When the vicar gives you the red card, I'm calling in Thursday, yes?"
I didn't reply. For some reason, I was having a sudden heavy bout of déjà vu.
"Thursday," repeated Aubrey. "You okay? You look like you're in a dream world."
"I'm fine," I said slowly. "I'll wait for your command."
"Good."
We all did the harumph thing again, and they went to their places, whilst I sat on the bench and looked once again at the scoreboard. We were losing, 21-12. The klaxon went off, and the game started with renewed aggression. Biffo whacked the yellow ball in the direction of the up-end hoop and hit the whacker's ball. Warg took the roquet. With an expert swing, the opponent's ball tumbled into the Italian sunken garden, and ours sailed as straight as a die over the rhododendrons. A distant clack was mirrored by a roar from the crowd, and I knew the ball had been intercepted by Grunk and taken through the hoop. Aubrey nodded at Smudger, who took out the Duchess in grand style. They both careered into the tea party and knocked over the table. The klaxon sounded for a time out, while the Duchess was pulled clear of the tea things. She was conscious, but had a broken ankle. Smudger was given the red card, but no hoop penalty, as the Duchess had been shown the yellow card earlier for concussing Biffo. I joined the fray as play started up again, but the whacker's earlier confidence was soon evaporating under a withering attack from the Neanderthals, who could anticipate their every move simply by reading their body language. Warg passed to Grunk, who gave the ball such an almighty whack that it passed clear through the rhododendrons with a tearing of foliage and was converted by Zim on the other side towards an undefended hoop. By the time there were 3 minutes to play, we had almost caught up. 25 hoops to the whackers, 29. Firmly rattled, the whackers missed a roquet, and with only a minute to run, scored their 30th hoop with us only 2 behind. All they had to do to win was peg out by hitting the centre post. While they were trying to do this, and we tried our best to stop them, Grunk, with 8 seconds to go and 2 hoops to make, whacked a clear double hooper that went through 1 up-end hoop, all the 40 yards down the green and through the mid. I never heard a crowd yell more. We had levelled the score and desperately tried to get our ball to the peg in the scrum of players trying to stop the whackers from doing the same. Warg grunted to Grunk, who ran towards the scrum and tore into them, taking 6 players down as Warg whacked the ball towards the now unprotected peg. It hit the peg fair and square, but a second after the klaxon had sounded, play had ended in a draw.